Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The 36th annual NIMROD Conference for Readers and Writers takes place tomorrow at the University of Tulsa, featuring readings, workshops, and book signings with the judges and winners of the NIMROD Literary Awards in Fiction and Poetry, as well as some distinguished master teachers. My guest today is the poetry judge for the NIMROD Pablo Neruda Prize, W.S. DePiro. DePiro is the author of 11 collections of poetry, including his 2014 collection Tombo, as well as 5 collections of essays and translations of Italian poetry. He was the winner of the Poetry Foundation's 2012 Ruth Lilly Prize for Lifetime Achievement. He's a native of South Philadelphia, and DePiro is a professor emeritus of English at Stanford and was on faculty at the Wallace Stegner Poetry Workshop as well. His poetry is known for what the Poetry Foundation calls a gritty realism, and that's whether it's reminiscing about his old neighborhood in Philly or contemporary life in the Bay Area or the Italian neighborhoods where he frequently travels. He'll be speaking several times during the conference tomorrow, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. W.S. DePiro, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Would you start by reading us a poem?
I'll read the first poem in my latest book. The title of the book is Tombo. The title of this poem is The Running Dog. Life, as you say, my friend, is lived in its transitions. And there's a yonder taking place right here. It lives in the electric air of field or room, unseen but palpable as snow or blowing dust. A breakfast of poached eggs, spiked coffee, newsy talk, crushed sun behind the clouds, marine layer vapors phasing blue to green, and the body quivers through its days, unawares but sensate, like a dreaming dog in the still marbled air of its own running. The felt and numb times in between that are the things around us, this pigeon feather, acorn, rinds and grounds and crusts, any this or that, or words that pass between us, while we keep trying to say, here by the stove or on your street, exactly what it's like.
That's nice. That's nice. You talk about transitions and the collections in three sections. I'm wondering if a lot of these poems are about transitions in life.
There's one section of the book in particular where there are a lot of poems about losses of different kinds. And that's probably the biggest transition that life offers us. And others not. I suppose I pay more attention in my poems to missed moments, dropped moments, in-between moments, than I do to very foregrounded events.
So you're not writing as therapy, you're writing about, like that last poem, there's the image of the sleeping dog who's running, and that's a very common image that most of us see if we've ever owned a dog. You've watched the dog dreaming and running. And
well, we experience it when we go all doggy in our sleep and shift and run and wake up out of it, you know.
Yeah. But I think it's one of those, you were talking about moments lost or missed. It's something we might look at and move on. And that at least became a point of imagery for this particular poem.
Yeah, well, poets are specialists in the noticing business.
True.
You know, that's a lot of the work of poetry is you pay attention, you notice, and then you try to find a way of bringing over the feeling of that act of noticing into words. Not just name it, say, I saw this, I saw that, but to bring over the feeling of seeing something or tasting something. I take that to be part of my work.
That's a kind of interesting, that being a part of your work, because there are so many parts of the day that we sort of sleepwalk through, you know, the average person does. Is that something you're always aware of when you sort of kind of go into that, say, like the daily commute or the route you take every day in walking to and from somewhere? You know, that sort of, you're awake, but you're sort of sleepwalking while you're awake. You're thinking about other things and not being aware of time and place. Is that something you're keenly aware of when you're doing it and to stop and look around?
I'm a distracted person usually because my head is...
Well, all of us are, yeah.
Entirely, you know. But a lot of the work of becoming a poet, I suppose, is preparation so that you're somehow living your life in a way that you're prepared to receive. And sometimes that state of distraction, of looking away from something, is when something comes to you. I mean, looking away, being distracted, is yet another form of preparation for a poet. What matters is that you're always prepared to receive whatever it is that the world offers up, and then start taking it toward words, if you can.
The final poem in this collection, in fact, the title poem, Tambo, sounds like it could have been one of those moments. You're in a grocery store. There's a person who's disturbed in some way
absolutely disturbed,
not being a danger to anybody, but just being loud and offering his praise to Tambo. And I assume you witnessed that. Is that a moment when you say this is going to be a poem, or do you reflect on it, or how did this end up becoming on the page?
I never have that feeling of having an actual experience and in that moment saying, this is going to become a poem. I don't relate the subject matter. I've never been the kind of poet who says, maybe I'll be able to get a poem out of this event.
No plain air painting in your poetry.
No. But as to the originating event, everything in my poems is true. That is, everything actually happened. But poetry is also, part of the work of poetry is invention and imagining. And one of the dynamics of the imagination is to conflate, to fuse, to mix, to composite things. And so that particular poem, Tambo, everything's true, and nothing happened in exactly that order. Somebody reviewed the book, speaking of that poem, referred to what this street character... I live in San Francisco.
Right.
Okay, so there's
plenty
just
of street characters.
There's a lot of presence, you know. And so they seem... The characters, these folks, and they're also some sign of real lesions in the social order. Anyway, the reviewer described what this guy is doing in Safeway as if is evangelizing, and it's just the right word. If you'd like me to read it, I would love to read it.
Since people are probably saying, what is this poem about?
People who haven't yet gotten to it, they ask me where the title comes from, and all I can say is you have to read the book. It's just the way it is. I mean, I didn't know that Tambo was a real word, that it's the name of a tuna, that it's a dialect among the Dogon tribe, and two or three other things.
But it's not a deity.
Not yet.
Well, let's read the poem. Why don't you read the poem so people will know what we're talking about?
Tambo. In Safeway yesterday, a young man sat on the floor, pulled off his shoes, granted audience to us, his fellow seekers, and picked his naked feet. He smiled, our brother, at the story he told of deliverance at the hand of Master Tambo, Lord and Creator, whose round energy lives in us, surrounds our milk, our butter, our eggs. See him there, in the slurpy glaze upon the freezer case, in that elder by the yogurt shelves. I believed his happiness, and coveted a tidy universe. He picked his feet while a child whimpered by the melons. Her nanny's mango aura made the cold blown air touch my brain. I smelled myself in my aging body and felt my silly bones collapse again. I wanted Tambo's dispensation to save this faint believer and the indifferent world that rivers through and past me. Down my aisle, lavender respired from the flower stall, and security spoke kind words to our prophet. Oh, I love and hate the fickle, messy wash of speech and flowers and winds and tides, and crave plain, rotund stories to justify our continuity. To the Maya, corn was God. Spilled blood made corn grow. The blood gods shed watered needy ground and became people who worshipped the corn. Tambo's grace can carry us, convinced, from one inarticulate, incoherent moment to the next. Tonight, the wet streets and their limelight sigh. Orion on fire turns, unchanged again. Bread rises somewhere, and its ovens scent the trees. My poor belief lives in the only and all of the slur of what these are. And what these are streams toward loss in moments we live through. As children, we were lost in our opaque acts, but fresh and full in time. I remember how I touched a girlish knee, how one boy broke another's face, how we all stood in hard gray summer rain so it would run down the tips of noses to our tongues.
That's very nice. That's very nice. I love the fact that you set this in a grocery store. You know, the grocery store is somewhat of a symbol of everything we could ever want or need, yet it's absolutely empty and it's full, you know, it's only temporary. It's, and here you have this street evangelizer, if you will, the street person talking about eternity as opposed to temporary.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, supermarkets are what they are. I mean, that's, and they contain plenitude or offer plenitude. But plenitude can be spiritually sick-making. plenitude of different kinds,
right.
You know, whether it's sensuous or material in a supermarket, whatever.
My guest today is W.S. DePiro, who will be a guest for the Nimrod Conference for Readers and Writers tomorrow at the University of Tulsa. He was the judge for this year's Nimrod Pablo Neruda Prize for Poetry. His 11th and latest collection, you just read the title poem, Tambo, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Now, you've been in California, in the Bay Area, for a number of years, but you grew up in Philadelphia. And when I went back and read some of your earlier poetry, I was wondering if the rhythm of your poetry has changed from living on the West Coast as opposed to the East Coast. You know, there's that great sort of stereotype that, you know, California is laid back, the East Coast is boom, 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 you know, fast moving. Have you noticed that at all about your writing?
No, the rhythms haven't changed. And I grew up in South Philadelphia,
yeah,
which in Philadelphia is a particular designation.
Right, yeah, no, I know. It's right. Like South Boston.
Yeah. I grew up in a very, very old style Italian immigrant working class neighborhood. And no, I think what has happened is that as I've grown and developed as a poet over the past 30 years, one thing you do as an artist is you test different velocities, different speeds. So I don't think of poems that have to do with my upbringing in that place as having different speeds or different rhythms, as you put it, than poems that I've written in other places. The textures are a little different because the materials are different. The textures come out of the, you know, this, just the sounds that the words make. And each place, in a way, offers a different vocabulary. Subjects offer different vocabularies.
The places are as different as different can be, can they? Or
yeah.
or do you find there's similarities between?
Well, no, you know, no. walking to the studio here today, I take great pleasure in seeing fallen leaves.
Right.
For instance.
Yeah, right.
We do have an autumn in San Francisco, but it doesn't come anywhere near the operatic, right, as autumns can be in places that have hardwood trees and such things. Now that you mention it, probably living in San Francisco, I've probably had more to say about the changefulness of weather.
There's a strain of weather going through this collection. I mean, it's the fog rolling in. It's the Cooper's Hawk. You're seeing nature as it exists in California. I was wondering if those were the same themes. Were you talking more about the street and when you're thinking to Philadelphia, or because there's a strong nature element in the California?
Yeah. Well, I can't make a generalization. I can only speak from my own practice, but I think of myself as a local poet, and so whatever the locality might be. And several years ago, I made a selected poems. And in making that book, I was really reviewing revisiting not just poems, but the nature of the places out of which poems came. And they come from different places. They come from northern New England, from South Philadelphia, also from Italy, where I've spent a number of years of my adult life. I've spent most of the years of my adult life, however, in Northern California and in the San Francisco area.
Now, at one point, if I remember right, didn't you teach at like LSU or somewhere down south?
I started. That was my first teaching job. I was teaching freshman comp at Louisiana State University.
Now, were you writing poetry then?
Sure.
Did the poetry have a different feel there as opposed to, say, the other places? You said you have an Italian phase.
I noticed this when I went back and reread all this stuff with the selected poems. That swamp and bayou stuff of different sorts turns up. There's a poem, a very early poem of mine from the 1970s, which is about the bonfires that kids light along the shores of the Mississippi outside New Orleans around Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
And the poem itself is not about local color. Local color doesn't interest me. But it is about conflagration and how we love fire, this destructive element, but we love it.
Mm-hmm.
Place, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a poet that place doesn't matter to. Even to Milton, heaven and hell mattered a lot.
Yeah, that's true. Well, one of the things I noticed about this latest collection, I don't know that this is the case, but I got a sense that there's a sense of the poet, the narrator, if you will, the person that's telling us this poem, there's a thought of aging. There's several poems that reflect on, I think you said earlier, there's several that really are directly connected to loss, but even the ones that are not really directed towards loss, there's a sense that times are changing. I'm thinking of a poem called The Goldberg Variations, which starts out on a rift of, I thought it was a fish, not a piece of hair behind your head, and it's about a mullet. And I assume it's about a reflection on a person who's making bad choices in boyfriends.
That's exactly what the poem is about. And it's also about the desire for something that's complete.
Like the Goldberg Variations.
Like the Goldberg Variations, like a great hamburger. You asked about transitions earlier, and one of them is when the body starts to fail you when you're in your mid to late 60s. And I'm in my late 60s. And I'm an especially, I guess, physical creature. And when you start to feel any failure in powers, it gets your attention. Because the next step is recognizing the limits, the finitude of things, you know. And I don't dwell on it. It's not the kind of thing that I, you know, my shoulders sag when I think about it. but it is something to be reckoned with, to be greeted and responded to in poems.
I think it is. It's something you can take solace from as you're dealing with your own. You know, when you read a poem that's talking about this, maybe even obliquely, it has a way of resonating with the reader.
Yeah, you know, the poets who live long enough, I mean, Shakespeare lived into his 50s, which was quite old then. He wrote about fading powers or surrendering powers. In different plays, he wrote about in King Lear and The Tempest. Whitman wrote about growing old. Yeats wrote about growing old. Some poets are arrested at a much different time of life. You know, Rimbaud, Keats. It's another subject. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Earlier, you made a couple mention of art, and you referred to an artist that's constantly evolving and trying to find the right form and the right expression. And I know you do a lot of art criticism, and I read some of the criticism, and I really enjoyed it a lot. You do a monthly column for the San Diego Reader, and it looks like it's reviewing museum openings, maybe gallery openings, Does that inform your writing in any way when you're looking at an artist, especially, I would think, looking at a retrospective of an artist, that would be a sort of inspiration for a path for any art?
Yeah, I started writing about the visual arts in 1985, writing essays and such things. And then in 1999, the San Diego Reader hired me to write a regular column. And in the column, the columns are really mini essays, which cover exhibitions in L.A., in San Diego, and wherever I might find myself. They give me a lot of swing and sway. My editor at the Reader is great. And he lets me forage far and wide. To answer your question, when I was first, when I had some, my first feeling that writing poetry might be my work. When I was about 20 years old, I was studying the poets of the past to learn my craft, to have some sense of all the voices that have come before me, and at the same time, I was very caught up in the work of three artists. Giacometti, above all, very close second was Paul Klee, mm-hmm. and Brancusi. For some reason, these artists, their work, just seized me when I was 19-ish. And so, as I was conceiving the possibility of being a poet, while I was writing poems and studying the poets, I was at the same time having another conversation, and that conversation was with these particular artists and other artists, and it's a conversation that went on.
I'm really interested in those three artists of why you chose them, because they seem to represent three very different, I mean, they're all modern artists, but they're three very different looks, or if you will, or three. Klee, I think of a lot of nervous energy in the canvases. Brancusi, all these sleek, you know, lines. And then Giacometti is this sort of, you know, elongated figurative forms with all these rough edges that are just left.
Well, you know, Giacometti appealed to me and still appeals to me. I just a few weeks ago, after many years, I revisited his work. I was asked to write a little catalog essay for an exhibition about his drawings. But back then, what most appealed to me in Giacometti was that his art really looked like it was suffered into existence.
Uh-huh.
And it may be that, you know, as a young artist, you're more susceptible to that and find that extremely compelling than you would, perhaps, if you were an already formed and practiced and experienced mature artist looking at Giacometti's work for the first time. So I was seized by that. But he did become a lifelong, you know, thing for me. Klee, on the other hand, looked like it was like an art that hadn't been so much suffered into existence as played into existence, toyed into existence. That it was that wit was essential to it. And I loved looking at Paul Klee's lines, just following the lines. And Brancusi was, all artists have their aspirations, and the aspirations are worked out in the kind of work that they do. And his was an absolutely different kind of aspiration, because it was what I was seeing in it anyway. It was mostly perfected forms and flight.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I saw in Brancusi. So I was seeing in Brancusi things I wasn't seeing in Klee, and certainly wasn't seeing in Giacometti. And I was 19, 20 years old, so I was seized by that as I was making myself into a person who's going to use words to make art.
Well, you do make wonderful words into art, and I really appreciate getting to know you. W.S. DePiro, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Poet W.S. DePiro speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He was the judge for this year's Nimrod Literary Prizes and the Pablo Neruda Prize. He'll be one of the guest speakers for the 36th Annual Nimrod Conference for Readers and Writers, which takes place tomorrow at the University of Tulsa. For more information on his appearance and the conference, visit utulsa.edu/Nimrod. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.